Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Susan Glasser. Here we go again. The horrible shootings in Buffalo, in Texas, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just this week. As a political reporter in Washington, I've watched this cycle play out for decades. A massacre and calls for gun control, politicians here in Washington throwing up their hands, saying there's nothing we can do. The power of the NRA is just too strong. Just the other day, that was the very first response that President Biden had to the latest outrageous incident, to say, when is it going to be time to challenge the power of the gun lobby? But maybe, just maybe, it's time to rethink that narrative. In fact, in many ways, it's striking how much the National Rifle Association has become hobbled politically in recent years. Their civil action in New York State, it's become an enormous and costly drain on the organization's finances. Then there's the fact that the NRA's election spending, once feared, has fallen precipitously since 2016. Membership has also been falling. Its leadership has been beset by years of infighting and scandal. Few reporters know more about the NRA and the plague of gun violence in America than Mike Spies. He's covered the organization and its inner workings in a series of really terrific pieces for The New Yorker and The Trace, a nonprofit news organization. You know, I have to say, Mike, there's an incredible amount of fatalism here in Washington. Again and again, we know how this story plays out. We hear senators talking about, no, this time is different. I'm hoping maybe you can help me challenge that fatalism in our conversation today. Given all the turmoil at the NRA, is it really true that it's as powerful as it was a decade ago? Or is it perhaps becoming something of a paper tiger?
Oh, well, first of all, just want to say thank you so much for having me on, Susan. Despite the, you know, tragic events over the last few weeks, I'm really glad that we can have this conversation. I do think it would be accurate to characterize the NRA at this stage as a paper tiger. You mentioned that it's been, you know, beset by leadership infighting, and also you mentioned the civil action in New York. And really, that's just part of it. I mean, historically, the way the NRA would have been able to respond to events like those that have taken place over the last few weeks would have been through its incredibly successful PR campaigns that were carried out by this firm called Ackerman McQueen that no longer works with the NRA. They had a very, very, very bitter divorce that began in 2019. And that firm is responsible for all of its most powerful messaging campaigns. And without them, there's really no way for the organization to communicate with its members, with lawmakers, that fear that it's known for instilling in people who pass laws. Spending was one part, but it was really the messaging that kept people in check. Without that, I don't buy into the idea at all that the organization really has any power at the moment. So it's really up to the Republican Party to make its own decisions at this stage. There's not really a threat from outside.
Well, you know, this is a really important point. You made this right away, actually, I think, in the aftermath of the Texas mass shooting. The Republican Party, you tweeted, is no longer beholden to the NRA. It does not need to, quote unquote, stand up to the gun lobby. What you're basically saying is that the NRA has been absorbed into the DNA and the bloodstream of the Republican Party. It's not that they're taking orders from this outside lobby, but that they have become the gun lobby themselves. Is that what I'm to read into that statement from you?
Correct. It's actually, the NRA was almost too successful for its own good. It doesn't even really need to exist anymore. I mean, obviously, there are some people that would disagree with that, but in terms of politics, policy, there is no daylight between the Republican Party and any positions the NRA holds. And obviously, there are no Democrats that are sympathetic to the NRA anymore. So it's really that organization's purpose in terms of at least getting laws passed or blocking laws from getting passed is kind of like irrelevant. And the other point I'd make is that regarding, you know, the idea of standing up to the gun lobby, I was actually quoting the president on that point. And I think that the Democrats do themselves a profound disservice by continuing to make the conversation about the NRA. It ultimately sort of lets the Republican Party off the hook. It's sort of dumb politics from my personal perspective. I don't understand why you'd make it about that. It's not as if everyone's not aware that the historically most powerful gun rights group in the country has effectively been defanged.
So, Mike, we're talking about the institutional decline and even implosion in some ways of the NRA in recent years. Give us a quick, you know, sort of guide to the metrics here. You know, what exactly are we talking about here when we say that the NRA's power has declined?
Well, a good barometer is its yearly revenue, which is the lowest it's been since 2006. Right now, it's under $100 million, which is just sort of a shocking place for the organization to be in at this stage. And it's still caught up in its civil action in New York, which is the primary drain on its resources. And as a result of that, has not been able to make any significant election outlays, really, since 2016.
Remarkable. Really, you're saying that, in effect, our old image of this outside force dictating to the Republicans is really an outdated one, and yet the collapse of the NRA organizationally and institutionally has not led to a weakening of the power of guns as a object almost of existential faith in the Republican Party. I saw a T-shirt the other day when Donald Trump went to Wyoming to campaign against Liz Cheney, one of his, you know, great enemies, and there was a little kid in the crowd. I wonder if you saw this, wearing a T-shirt that said, God, guns, and Trump, which to me in almost summed up the modern Republican catechism.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a perfect encapsulation of the current moment. I mean, in some ways, it's just, you know, guns have become sort of like a culture war flashpoint, like I guess any of the other culture war flashpoints, including, you know, abortion. There's no gray area. It's either just like you're either in a sort of very general blanket way, you're for regulation or you're against regulation. I think obviously because the Republican Party so willingly absorbed the NRA's platform over the, you know, many years, it's painted itself into a rhetorical corner. So any wiggle room that it could have had, I mean, I don't, maybe it feels like it doesn't have any more, but I do think that the party also sees the gun issue as advantageous, as something to rally around, that it's a useful way to turn out voters. It's deeply cynical and disturbing, especially when much of the response to the most recent shootings, when it comes to statistics about gun-free zones and other arguments that are just wrong, or been entirely generated in years past by the NRA, rhetoric that grew out of responses to other mass shootings like Sandy Hook. Even with this conversation about school hardening right now is ridiculous, not just because it's implausible, but because that too was a public relations response, first to Sandy Hook and then to Parkland. And that was a response that was generated by the NRA at a time that the NRA still had money and was still functioning like a semi-normal organization. But that's over.
This is kind of fascinating to me as well, Mike. So you're saying basically that the NRA kind of created the template for how to respond to these mass shootings and deflect the inevitable calls for greater gun regulation. But now it's almost been absorbed into the Republican Party's bloodstream. So the question is, do they still need the NRA to generate that energy and that turnout around stopping gun regulation that Republicans have been relying on and that they may need to rely on again in this midterm election? Like, does the weakened NRA have any on-the-ground election consequences that they don't have the war chest that they did in the past or the organizational heft?
I don't think that there is anything the NRA can do to any federal lawmaker right now. I mean, maybe it's conceivable that, like, in one race, one congressional race, I don't really see it. I mean, they don't have the money to spend. They don't have the contractors who are responsible for the messaging to help them carry out the sort of rhetoric and campaigns that would have previously resonated with voters. It's just there's just no world in which I can imagine that organization having a measurable effect on any single race. The only threat that a Republican could face potentially would be like in a primary situation. But even then, I mean, how's that going to work? The NRA is not in a position anymore, if it ever was on the federal level, to draft a new primary opponent entirely based on one vote. I just don't see that realistically happening.
Does that mean that we should take away that there is the possibility of some kind of a breakthrough. There are these bipartisan talks happening once again among a group of senators. You had Susan Collins from Maine, perhaps perennially overly optimistic, saying that they had made great progress in these talks. But even Chris Murphy, the Democrat from Connecticut, who's been a longtime advocate of gun control measures, he even said the other day, well, this time feels different. I feel like, you know, the ingrained response in Washington is to be like, wait a minute, you know, we've been down this road before. Like, don't, you know, but is it possible that the weakening of the NRA makes it more possible that there could be a breakthrough?
I don't want to say it's impossible. And obviously, I couldn't say that. I do think it's in some ways on the Democrats right now to effectively message and tell like a compelling story. And I think one way in which they're not doing that is by relying on this old trope about the NRA instead of focusing on the actual lawmakers who are prohibiting or preventing progress on the issue. So the question is, you know, I guess it's more of a tactical issue. Can the Democrats effectively publicly pressure at least 10 Republican lawmakers and squeezing them into doing something? I want to believe that that's possible, and maybe it is, but we're not going to even get to that point if the Democratic Party and leadership insists on continuing to talk about the NRA as opposed to talking just about this being a Republican issue, not a gun lobby issue.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You've devoted a lot of your recent reporting career really to the subject of this organization. Many New Yorker readers will remember your extraordinary reporting about Wayne LaPierre and his wife and their horrific elephant hunt. So walk us through what you see as the key steps along this organization's kind of decline and implosion. Why did it, you know, blow up in the face of its own success?
Well, I think, you know, on the surface, it was obviously quite successful. And I mentioned it had this PR firm, Ackerman McQueen, that was quite good at coming up with programming that really resonated with people, especially in the Trump era, when the culture war came back with such a powerful force. On the inside, though, the issue of profligate spending and self-dealing was always happening. Or had been happening for decades. So it was just sort of at what point were the chickens going to come home to roost? I guess the most fatal misstep was launching this program called Carry Guard. It was effectively self-defense insurance, insurance you buy in the event that you shoot somebody. You know, your legal costs would be covered if you had this. And that just wound up being a disastrous program. And that ended up leading certain employees in the NRA's accounting department to go on a fact-finding mission as they began to notice some things that didn't make sense. And before you knew it, turned out there were quite a lot of people that had their hand in the till and were giving out sweetheart contracts, taking things for themselves. And eventually, it, I guess, as I said, it all spilled out into the open. And the organization has, of course, never been the same since. In fact, I mean, if you really think about it, the last remaining holdout is Wayne LaPierre. Everyone else is gone.
He was just renamed CEO last weekend. How is that even possible in light of, you know, scandals that would have taken down the leader of almost any other organization I can think of?
Yeah, well, it really raises questions about the NRA's board. How serious is the board? A lot of the board members that wanted to remove Wayne from power, wanted to launch an internal investigation, or were interested in reform, most of them resigned. Perhaps because they thought it wasn't possible. But Wayne is the last man standing, and the question of who Wayne is very important. And you mentioned the elephant hunting story. I mean, obviously when that story came out, understandably, people were very focused on the fact that Wayne and his wife, Susan LaPierre, traveled to Botswana to kill endangered elephants, which just in and of itself is a horrible, unconscionable thing to do. But there was a separate story within that story, which was that Wayne, when you see him with the curtains pulled back, is not the public persona that the members and the rest of us encounter. He's a bumbling, sort of meek, shy man who really can't even handle a firearm. And the point of the video really is to show that he's forced to shoot an elephant at close range repeatedly and is unable to kill it, and is so ineffective with the gun that eventually at some point someone else has to step in and kill the elephant for him. In fact, one of the guides that he was with seemed fairly concerned about Wayne's ability just to simply safely handle the firearm, that at one point he put his hand on the gun's barrel and raised it toward the sky because it looked like he was afraid that he was going to shoot somebody in the crew by accident. Which is, again, brings me back to the point of, is there anything to be scared of if you're a lawmaker, right? That's who's left, is that Wayne. The Wayne that people theoretically might have been scared of was the Wayne that was created by the PR firm Ackerman McQueen and their gun.
That was my takeaway rereading the piece as well. It's almost the Wizard of Oz with the curtain pulled back, right? You know, Wayne Pierre is just a sort of the old dude, you know, who doesn't really know how he ended up the Master of Oz.
Right.
And yet our politics is where they are. After Sandy Hook, sort of the modern horrible template, you know, we've been living with, it was LaPierre who said the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Obviously, that's been debunked in what's happened again and again and again. And yet it seems that our politics haven't really shifted. And so one of the questions I have is, given this new reality, do you see any shifts in the politics in the Republican Party since the collapse of the NRA's mighty image?
Well, it doesn't seem like they're yet willing to come to terms with reality. And part of that is, I mean, one thing that the NRA did very successfully over a long period of time, which the party bought into, wasn't just the political spending, which was one thing, mentioned the messaging campaigns and NRA TV. What it actually really did well was nurture gun culture, turning gun culture into like a lifestyle. It's not just about the gun. It's a lot bigger than that. It's sort of, I always make this comparison, but it's sort of like, you know, if you're a massive Grateful Dead fan and you're a Deadhead, there's a whole lifestyle that comes along with that. And that's not so different when it comes to gun culture and sort of this idea that the NRA created. You could even compare it to religion. I mean, you mentioned that T-shirt earlier. It's like God, guns, Trump. You know, like that's the package. You know what I mean? Like there's a larger thing that's happening that's harder to push back against. And I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I think that like once you've given your life over to an idea or like, you know, if you're the kind of person that needs that sort of organizing principle for their life, I think it's extremely hard to let that go, even after the curtain's been pulled back. The party, you know, is complicit in that. The Republican Party is complicit in sort of being unwilling to tell the truth about it.
You know, this incredible sort of culture war and cultural branding of guns is clearly a part of a power that transcends whether or not the NRA itself is strong. Why do you think it's been so hard for Democrats to craft a compelling counter narrative? I mean, many people look at the number of polls out there that show incredible support for a long list of potential gun control measures, including among self-identified Republican voters, even including self-identified NRA members. And yet there's no counter-cultural war going on here, it seems. There's no, you know, alternate politics of guns that Democrats have been able to channel. Why is that?
Well, I think one reason might be that while there is a lifestyle built around gun culture, and while that idea is pretty deep and potent as almost, again, like a, kind of like a religion, there's not an answer to that on the other side. There's no anti-gun culture. gun culture is built around a lot of ideas, right? I mean, it's like just the notion of going into the woods with your dad and hunting. And it's just, it's about, it's America. It's like all these American myths are sort of rolled into that idea. You know, there's rugged individualism. There's the idea of being a protector. If you went ever been to an NRA annual meeting, there are lots of seminars that incorporate the word sheepdog. You know, how to be a sheepdog. And this concept of being a sheepdog is like this sort of person who takes it upon themselves to protect the sheep society from the wolves that would do them harm. There's no narrative on the other side of that. In order to, I think, sway people, you need to be able to replace that narrative that resonates so deeply with a lot of Americans with a different one. And that's unfortunately just not something that's available to Democrats. I do think, you know, also in addition to that, the Democratic Party's not been particularly creative on the issue. It always comes back to the same ideas every time. You know, we need background check, just sort of the very basic talking points that they've absorbed. And it's not very helpful, and it doesn't often feel authentic. And it can also be confusing. One thing the Democratic Party could do would be to perhaps start recruiting better ambassadors for its messaging. But I think the entire approach needs to be rethought. Or the other option is, this is the one issue it seems that Joe Manchin is willing to vote like a Democrat. And so in this case, it does feel like a national emergency. The question is, you know, obviously the blowing up the filibuster is not, it is a path. I don't know if it's the best one or not, but it is technically a path, and in this case would seem to be one potentially available to Democrats.
Mm-hmm. The Trace has an excellent project called How We Fix This that tracks different interventions and solutions to gun violence. Can we talk just for a second about what some of the more practical options were there to be a bipartisan breakthrough? Again, you know, it's hard for me, having been around this again and again and again, to listen when Susan Collins talks about rapid progress. But still, let's indulge in that exercise for a second here. What do you see as some of the more pragmatic options that are available to these senators right now?
You know, it seems like there's some bipartisan support for red flag laws, and those, I think, could genuinely be valuable and help stop shootings. For those who aren't familiar with them, it's a path that allows people who are usually family members, it allows people to, through court order, have someone's guns temporarily removed from their home, you know, from them, because of concerning behavior, you know, that kind of thing. And that seems like a realistic way to fill in gaps in the background check system. Obviously, when people undergo background checks, they don't get reference checks. They check to see if they've ever committed a felony, if they're of age, that sort of thing. But they don't know, for example, whether or not you have serious anger management problems, or if you're someone who's had a propensity to display violent behavior, that kind of thing. The only way that that would ever be known, made known to law enforcement in a way that could be preventative, would be through red flag laws, where somebody who intimately knew a potential shooter because their family would be able to use the courts to potentially head off a shooting by getting someone's firearms removed.
So it seems like you have some hope that it can happen, which I guess is maybe an important note to end this conversation on, because I have to say my worry is, between now and when we go ahead and post this podcast, if, you know, the statistics of this year are any guide, there's going to be another mass shooting event defined, you know, as, say, four or more people shot between when you and I are talking and when people are listening to this conversation, Mike. It's so dreadful.
It is very dreadful. I do think it's possible. I guess I'll just come back to my original point. I think that it is incumbent upon the Democratic Party to make this about the Republican Party and not about the NRA. It is a decision to not take steps to consider new regulations that might actually be useful is a choice. It is a choice that's being made without real fear or anything to really worry about. And I think that that's worth pointing out over and over again. And I hope that that gets taken to heart.
Mike, I want to really thank you for sharing your expertise on this very painful subject and that important insight with us. Guns are a choice. They're a choice that America has made. They're a choice that America's political system and its politicians have made. So I want to thank you so much for all the journalism you've done on this important subject. Mike Spies is a senior writer at The Trace, which is a nonprofit news organization covering guns in America and a very valuable contributor to The New Yorker. So thank you again for being with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Susan.
Our guest was Mike Spies, a senior writer at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization covering guns in America and a contributor to The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Susan Glasser. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.